dashing, dashing, restless sea. Never still you seem to be.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, it's been almost a year since the death of Trayvon Martin, a national conference on mass incarceration, and teachers in Seattle take a stand against high-stakes testing. But first, hundreds of parents and teachers gathered in Washington last week to protest school closings under President Obama's so-called Race to the Top program. The protesters called their action a journey for justice. Journalist Jaisal Noor covered the story for the Real News Network, and we spoke with him.
First of all, you had a group of several hundred, mostly African-American students and parents and community leaders and activists coming together, connecting their own local struggles against the Obama administration policies. And it comes at a time when so many Black leaders and leaders of color will not criticize Barack Obama, will not criticize his policies. It comes a few days after you had a show on even the so-called more liberal MSNBC, Melissa Harris Perry, doing a story about this same thing, about she had one of the parents on, who's very eloquent, very great, talking about the effects of these policies. But from what I can tell, the only mainstream media coverage of this on TV, you don't have the words Barack Obama, Arne Duncan, Race to the Top. And what his policies have done is disempower, defund schools that are almost exclusively in poor, low-income communities of color. And now you have, for the first time, parents uniting, communities uniting, students uniting, and taking a leadership role in challenging these policies and, in their own words, calling them racist. Racist policies that are violating the Civil Rights Act. And I had an opportunity to be in Detroit, and I got a tour of some of the city's recently closed down schools from a civil rights activist named Helen Moore. And she's been fighting this struggle for 40 years. And she took me to a school that she fought to get desegregated 40 years ago. They had a sit-in at that school, and they fought to get that school integrated, to make it serve Black students along with white students. And now that's one of the schools that have shut down. It's important to bring up that issue of civil rights, because civil rights is the mantra that the education reformers have used to justify these same policies of closing down schools, of high-stakes testing. And now you really see it that community leaders, grassroots leaders, not funded by corporations, have gathered together to really reclaim that, to reclaim civil rights, to defend public education, not to privatize it. So I think that's very significant.
And they called their trip to Washington a journey for justice. They're calling for a national moratorium on such school closings.
President Obama promised to close down 5,000 schools. 2010-2011 school year, according to the DOE's numbers, more than 1,900 schools were closed down around the country. This is a growing epidemic. Thanks to Race to the Top, thanks to No Child Left Behind before that, more and more schools will be rated unsatisfactory, rated as failing, and more and more of these communities are going to lose their institutions unless something is done about it. And another theme you see in a lot of these communities, whether it's Detroit, Oakland, New Orleans, is that 40 years ago, communities were fighting to get the right to vote in a lot of these same communities, to have an elected school board, and that's one of the things that's being closed down. One of the things being taken away is the elected, democratically elected school boards. So these communities have fought on a local level unsuccessfully, thanks to mayoral control, thanks to emergency managers like you have in Detroit, and there's no more venues to oppose these policies on the local level. In places where the school board is now is going back to being elected, like in Oakland, and in some cases New Orleans, you have the corporate education reformers spending tens of thousands of dollars or more on these local races. So you have an assault on various levels on the democratic input in how these schools are going to be run. So that's why they're appealing for the federal authorities to intervene, because the local authorities have proved themselves incapable or unwilling to take action against these school closings.
It appears that there's a deliberate policy of shutting down, closing public schools in order to make way, to make room for charter schools and to set up a kind of alternative system.
Well, what the education reformers, what Barney Duncan, what President Obama will tell you is that these schools are failing. They're dropout factories. We have to try something new. We have to give communities choice about where to send their students. And by doing this, this will enhance civil rights. But in practice, what this has meant is the exact opposite. In places like Chicago, what it's meant is that what school choice has meant is that students have to cross gang lines to get to school. Students have to basically risk their lives to get to school every day. What it's meant is that you have maybe quasi-accountable bodies being replaced by not-for-profit or for-profit private companies where there is no accountability. You have the siphoning of resources from public schools into these private institutions and the defunding of the public schools to set them up to fail. And so you have a cycle of these schools being constantly closed down. What about the students that are in those schools? This one student told me, a student in New Orleans told me that after this last Hurricane Irene, his school, which is a public school, was left for weeks with a flooded cafeteria that was in really poor condition. Whereas the students that attended the charter school that used that same building, their cafeteria was rebuilt within a few days. And so he's actually living, they're in the same school building, but they have an unequal reality because the charter school gets more funding. These are not acceptable conditions that exist in public schools today.
And this Journey for Justice demonstration is a milestone because all of this is being laid at President Obama's doorstep.
Absolutely. The organizers do not mince any words. They are appealing directly to President Obama. They met with Arne Duncan for a few minutes in the beginning of that hearing at the Department of Education, but they want to sit down with Barack Obama because they believe that in his heart he knows what's right, and once he gets to hear from their own voices what his policies are actually doing to their communities, that he will have to do something about it, and he'll have to intervene on the behalf of the federal government, which is pouring billions of dollars into closing down these schools and expanding charter schools. And they say, if he doesn't listen, if these policies continue, they will be back. This is actually the second Journey for Justice. There will be a third Journey for Justice. They're going to come back. They're going to try to increase their numbers tenfold and do civil disobedience if necessary. There's even talk about taking it to the UN, doing whatever it takes to get the attention of Obama and tell him these policies are not acceptable and they have to change.
That was journalist Jaisal Noor. Teachers in Seattle, Washington are taking a stand against high-stakes testing by refusing to administer an unnecessary test. Students and parents have lined up to support them. Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
In the most promising teacher and community resistance to corporate education reform since the Chicago Teachers Union strike last fall, instructors at Seattle's Garfield High School are standing up for their students by refusing to administer the so-called Measure for Academic Progress, or MAP, tests given in Seattle the last 3 years. Dissident teachers point out that the test, for which Seattle paid $4 million in a questionable no-bid deal, doesn't affect graduation, so students have never taken it seriously, and it's not aligned with existing state standards for what schools are required to teach or with the materials actually taught. In fact, the test has nothing to do with teaching or learning. Its purpose, under the model of corporate-inspired run-your-school-like-a-business education reform, is to generate so-called hard data, numbers to measure student progress, numbers that indicate teacher performance, and, as is happening in hundreds of school districts across the country, numbers that justify which schools will next be closed and replaced by charter operations which generate handsome profits off public dollars. Teachers point out that the MAP test, which is also given in Chicago, New York City, and elsewhere, is doubly specious because district administrators, quote, reported that the margin of error for this test is greater than an individual's expected score increase, unquote, from year to year, according to a story printed in the authoritative Substance News. The corporate school reform agenda insists, however, that this sort of testing go on everywhere because letting go of as many experienced teachers as possible is a vitally necessary step in privatization. Think about it. If you're a privatizing boss, experienced teachers don't just cost more. They know how to do their jobs without you. Some of them are organized to boot, with deep roots in your school's communities. The corporate model calls for making teachers into temporary workers on the Walmart and McDonald's models, with no ties to local communities and certainly with no tradition of collective action. This kind of testing labels schools and their students as failures. Seattle teachers are refusing to set their students and themselves up for failure. As in Chicago, community leaders and students themselves have come out to support their teachers, who have been threatened with 10-day unpaid suspensions. The test boycott, however, is spreading to other schools in Seattle and beyond. On January 26, teachers at a second Seattle high school, Chief Self, joined their Garfield College, pledging to boycott the tests, and teachers are reportedly considering the same move at other schools in Seattle, Portland, and elsewhere. There's a call-in and fax-in scheduled today, Wednesday, in support of Seattle teachers, and there are a number of online petitions in support of their efforts. In his 2012 State of the Union speech, President Barack Obama dropped a phrase about how teachers should not be required to teach to the test. We can tell, however, what side the president is on, not by his words, but by his policies. If he meant those words, he'll not only commend the stand Seattle teachers have taken, but suspend his signature Race to the Top program, which forces schools to give these tests to tie teachers' jobs to them, and whether schools in minority communities remain open to them. But we're not holding our breath on that one. For more news on the ongoing resistance to corporate school reform, check out Substance News at http://substance.net. For the latest in the situation in Seattle schools, the place to go is http://seattleeducation.wordpress.com.
That was Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon.
Newark, New Jersey City Councilman Ras Baraka is a public high school principal and son of poet and activist Amiri Baraka. This year, he's running for mayor, the job currently held by Cory Booker. Booker is beloved by corporations, Wall Street, and the corporate media. He plans to run for the United States Senate in 2014. We asked Ras Baraka how he'll overcome the obstacle of Cory Booker's money.
Cory Booker is running for Senate. You know, hopefully he continues to do that. So I don't think that his money is going to be completely involved in the race. I think that he's going to give money to specific people he supports, but he needs to save a lot of it for himself. All my life, you know, I've been involved in these campaigns for like 20 years. We've been running against machines. We don't know how to do anything else. You know, that's what we've been doing. In our South Ward race, we ran against Cory Booker's machine under the auspices of Oscar James Jr. They spent $1 million in the South Ward in one ward, which is probably what you need for a citywide race. They spent $1 million in one ward, and we beat them 2-3-1 in the South Ward with maybe 10 times less money than they had. So, and that's just basically, we build a solid kind of ground organization, a solid community organization that gets out the vote and engages the electorate.
But it does say something about his money that we can even talk about a machine.
I think that what they've been doing with the money is spreading it out, trying to buy people and get them involved on their side or employ people. But I think the people are, the electorate is a little bit wiser at this point. And I think either you have money or you have organization. And Booker never had a real solid street organization, really never had a real community organization that was based on the fact that they believed in him, that they saw his vision, that they thought the city would change. His organization was based on, you know, his money. And he never really spent the time to build any serious ground organization or engage the community in the way it needed to be engaged.
And where do you think your strength lies?
In that aspect, you know, we've had no other choice but to engage the community, and we've been doing that for the past 20 years. We've been in the community at the meetings, talking to people. I think we have a good kind of ground organization, a good street organization that would allow us to knock on doors and execute our plan. I think we have that, and it doesn't take a lot of money to put that together. And we are, however, attempting to raise some money, and I think we're going to raise a significant amount of money based on what we need for this campaign. But most of our resources and our strategy is going to be centered around our ground organization.
What's the number one issue facing Newark, the number one challenge, and how do you propose to meet it?
Oh, man, jobs. The unemployment or the folks that are disengaged from the labor force is at 30% or higher. Even those folks that have jobs, I mean, there's a lot of those people that have jobs are getting paid below the minimum wage. I mean, poverty in the city, we have almost half the city is like 200% below the poverty line. So, I mean, it's important that we fight for jobs, but living wage jobs. That, you know, the first year or so, we need to develop a program, a strategy to bring 5,000 to 10,000 jobs to the city. I mean, sustainable, self-sustainable kind of jobs, not just bringing companies into the city, but people, things that exist here already. We need to employ these folks. Our training programs, our Workforce Investment Board, our Youth Investment Council, all these organizations that exist, and these corporations, and these small businesses have not been able to put together a coordinated action plan to hire Newarkers. And I think we need to do that. We need a serious Hire Newarkers campaign. Anybody that does business with the city itself, the school board, all the universities, all other hospitals, all of the things that we have in the city, the airport, the seaport, we need to focus them clearly on making sure Newarkers are the majority of their workforce.
And we're talking about living wage jobs, right?
Absolutely. And so that means that we're going to have to attach the union to that and make sure that they're union jobs or people have the opportunity to bargain with their employer for their labor, that they have a decent job with decent health care, and that their wages are not decreasing but increasing or at least matching the minimum wage. We are never going to be able to turn the city around with half the city 200% below the poverty line. Poverty is a real issue in our community, and we have to address that through jobs, through economic development, through in our communities, not just downtown, through sustaining communities and sustaining families. We have a lot of hospitals here. The healthcare industry can be used as an economic hub for this community. It needs to be engaged that way. The airport, the seaport, all of the New Jersey Transit and everything else needs to be geared towards getting our people to those sites. I mean, there needs to be stops that stop in our community to take people to the airport, to the seaport, so they begin to connect those arteries so we can get to work there and we come back. And then we got to force some people at the airport and other places to pay our people a decent and living wage, because right now, the few people that do work up there are not getting a living wage. So that's important, I mean. And then on top of that, it's crime, but crime is directly connected to unemployment and poverty. So, I mean, there's a whole strategy that we have to engage in as treating crime and violence as public health and begin to deal with that in that capacity and not just centered around incarceration. We need to try to attack incarceration rates and by making sure we treat crime as public health and begin to provide the kind of resources and things that we need to support and sustain families.
Cory Booker has famously great relations with corporations and their CEOs and with Wall Street. Why hasn't that resulted in gobs of jobs for Newark?
Well, it's all based on will, man, you know, and vision. I mean, there's some people that have the ability to do things they just don't want to. I mean, that's not their will. That is not his focus. I think that people come to these inner cities like there was a new wave of Black elected officials who come to these inner cities and who completely rejected the notion of the civil rights generation and everything that people fought for and gained. And they kind of sided with, you know, the more conservative sectors of the society around this whole business model. You know, when they came here, they thought the problems with these communities were simply that we were incompetent and that the rest of us weren't incompetent, were crooks. But when they came here, they found out that the problems that face our community are actually systemic. Like, they're very serious, deep problems that have been ingrained in our community over decades, centuries even, and it's going to take some serious commitment and effort and brain power to do it. You're not going to be able to do it alone, you're not going to be able to do it overnight, and you're not going to be able to do it halfway. So you have some people who realize how heavy that problem was and decided not to deal with it at all, and to just basically be the darling of the media and get what they can from these corporations and move themselves forward. Their own ambitions, they just have big ambitions, just not big enough to include the rest of us. And then there are people who absolutely positively, they just don't care about it. So he lied in either one of those. Like, he either didn't care from the beginning about the problems that exist in our community, or he faced our problems and realized that it was just too heavy for him to deal with and carry out his own personal agenda at the same time.
City Councilman Ross Baraka, running for mayor in Newark, New Jersey.
February 26 marks the first anniversary of the killing of Trayvon Martin, the black teenager whose death at the hands of a vigilante in Sanford, Florida, set off huge protest. Carl Dix of Stop, Stop and Frisk has some ideas about what people should be doing on February 26.
Well, what they need to be doing on that day is taking to the streets in outrage. What they need to be doing leading up to that day is spreading the word on that. Because, look, it's 1 year since Trayvon Martin was stalked by George Zimmerman for being a black youth. I mean, George Zimmerman's words was, he must be up to no good. Why? Because he was young, black, and wearing a hoodie. That was enough for him to decide he was a criminal. After Zimmerman murdered him, telling the cops that was enough for them to walk him through the station and out the other side and cut him free. And it was not until people took to the streets in outrage all across the country that the state of Florida was forced to moonwalk back, rearrest the man, and charge him for his crime. But this has been a case that is dragging on, and essentially they're trying to play us. They're trying to see how long it takes for outrage to go away, to move on. And what we have to do is we have to see how this outrage concentrates something. It concentrates the way that black youth especially, but also Latino youth, walk around in this society with a bullseye on their back to be targeted by any racist vigilante, because Trayvon was not the last black youth in Florida to be gunned down like this. We have to remember Jordan Davis in November, shot by a white man who didn't like the volume of the music he and his friends were playing. We have to remember that the same criminalization is what leads to mass incarceration. 2.4 million people warehoused in prison, two-thirds of them black or Latino. People, when they get out of prison, treated as second-class citizens, racial profiling like Stop and Frisk and other things that serve as a pipeline into prison. We have to remember that all that is concentrated in this and understand that this is a horror that is unacceptable, racist, and illegitimate that should not be accepted in silence and refused to accept it in silence. So I've issued a call for people to take to the streets on the 26th, to wear hoodies, have some bags of Skittles there, to bring back memories of the rage around Trayvon, and from now until then, spread the word. Facebook, Twitter, take pictures of yourself and your partners, your crew, your classmates, the people you work with, wearing hoodies, and send those pictures to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network at stopmassincarceration@gmail.com. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word. We're going to send those pictures around the country and around the world. And people should be doing it. They should be tweeting about this. They should be Facebooking about it. Remember the rage that you felt when you heard that this young black man had been gunned down for no reason other than being young and black, and that the state of Florida questioned whether there was any crime committed. Remember that they drug tested Trayvon's dead body while letting his murderer walk free. Remember all that and react with the kind of outrage that's needed for this situation to demand justice for Trayvon, but also to build the kind of movement that can stop mass incarceration and actually get at its source, the capitalist system, the system that strips black and Latino neighborhoods of jobs and any access to legitimate ways to survive and raise families, that has our youth confronting an educational system geared to fail them and creates a situation where these youth have no hope for the future, that criminalizes them as a way to suppress them and, in fact, to carry out a counterinsurgency before an insurgency breaks out, to keep them from rising up against those miserable conditions, because they remember the system remembers the 1960s, even if sometimes black people, other oppressed people, tend to forget what we did and what we accomplished then, but also what remains to be accomplished, which is making revolution and getting rid of the system that's responsible not only for this horror, but for the wars for empire, the drone missile strikes that destroy whole villages, the brutality and degradation that women face all around the world, including right here in the U.S., raping of the very environment of the planet, and I could go on and on, but February 26th, we are all still Trayvon. The whole damn system is guilty, and we should act like it on February 26th, and don't keep nothing a secret. Spread the word on what you plan to do. Spread the word when you do it. Call on others to join you.
And since the massacre, mostly of white kids at Sandy Hook, Connecticut, we've had what purports to be a debate about gun control, but it appears that the only proposals that might have some traction would tend to increase stop and frisk and put more police in the public schools.
Yeah, I mean, we should be actually clear what's going on here. There is a sharp divide that has a right-wing fascist mobilization going on that is saying we need our guns to help suppress and, in fact, aid the state in further suppression. And if the state, the capitalist state, can't continue to suppress the oppressed, then we'll move in and do it ourselves. And at the same time, the supposed opposition to that, led by Obama and others, is mainly acting to show, no, we can suppress the masses. Be cool. Don't worry about the people in the inner city. We can put more police on them. We can target them, more cops in schools, and different approaches like that. Because if they really want to get at the root of, you know, they talk about, well, we have to do this to stop the violence in the inner cities. Well, they created the conditions that led to the violence in the inner cities. The stripping of ways to survive, employment opportunities, the education system that's geared to fail our youth, the fact that when people do get a strike against them, get arrested, get convicted once, then you come out of prison and you can't find a job, you can't get a loan to go back to school and try to get in position to get a decent way to survive. They created all of that. And that's all a part of this no future that a lot of our youth face growing up in a hopelessness. And what I have to say on that, I don't expect Obama and company to address that situation. Sometimes people say, well, why don't Obama say something about what's going on with black folks? Well, Obama's presiding over the system that's responsible for what's coming down on black folk. And his job is to keep that system intact. So he's not going to address it. What we have to be talking about is building a movement that can get rid of that system, a movement for revolution. And then part of that is fighting all of the attacks that come down, including these racist vigilante murders that have been concentrated in Florida related to expand your ground laws, but are not particular or peculiar to Florida, because we should remember Emmett Till, 1954, back when I was 5 years old, lynched by a white mob because they say he whistled at a white woman. And on from there, along with all of the police murders, you know, more than I could count, more than I could talk about right now. So we have a lot of reasons to be out in the street, and let's have a coming together of that on February 26th around Trayvon, but around all of the ways that this system has put a target, especially on the backs of our youth, because the youth are the future, and if they are allowed to get away with criminalizing our future, that basically comes down to no future. And that's why I call mass incarceration and all its consequences a slow genocide that could easily become a faster genocide. And through the course of this gun control supposed debate, some of the elements of that genocide get put into position, into place and position. Because as I've argued nonstop around mass incarceration, genocide's a process. It ain't an end thing where they line you up against the wall or put you in the camps and start gassing you. It's a process. And we are in that process as far as black people go. And Latinos have the dubious situation of being added to that genocidal list. So that people need to stand up and say no more to this. We have to beat this back and stop that genocide. I want to give two websites for people who want to get in touch and get involved. One is to go directly to the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which issued the call for February 26th, and that is www.stopmassincarceration.org. Stop Mass Incarceration, all one word. I also urge people to go to the Revolution newspaper website, which is www.revcom.us. I urge people to check that out.
That was Carl Dix of Stop, Stop and Frisk in New York City.
Students Against Mass Incarceration are planning a national conference on the campus of Washington's Howard University in April. PhD candidate Benjamin Woods is one of the organizers. Until recently, Woods and fellow student activists had worked with inmates in the Maryland prison system, but they've now been banned from the prisons as too radical. Benjamin Woods explains.
The program, it deals with, you know, it's prisoner ran. It started by Brother Marshall Eddie Conway and other prisoners, younger ones who were in their 20s even at the time when it was started. They said, we want to mentor other prisoners. We want to do things, you know, have discussions around, you know, whether it be political issues, whether it be, you know, family, whether it's, you know, learning how to do mediation, having people from the community like us or even lawyers come in, teach mediation, all those types of things, you know, life skills, debate skills, all those types of things. And this program that we were told was a good program has now been canceled indefinitely.
Because it takes too close a look at society and the actual conflicts.
That's the conclusion, you know, we're coming to. That, you know, we would actually have discussions about Franz Fanon. I led discussions around Wretched of the Earth and different things like that. I mean, that was the type of program it was running, you know, really getting to think, you know, about themselves and who is self and what is my position in the world and, you know, and get us to think and, you know, not see people, you know, coming in, see these people incarcerated as you know, possibly George Jackson, people who are incredibly well-read, brilliant people who we can learn from, even though we may be students.
And Students Against Mass Incarceration is having a national conference at Howard University in April.
April 19th and 20th, we're going to have our first annual national conference. You know, our organization started in February of 2011. It's been almost 2 years. We've managed to start 5 other chapters of our group. The intent is to bring back the black student movement, you know, especially around the most, what we consider to be the human rights issue of our generation. So we want to help start this organization, build, take it to another level, and really help to create a plan of action of what it is we as black students and young people can contribute to this movement.
Benjamin Woods of Students Against Mass Incarceration in Washington.
The Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission recently issued a report bragging that it had reduced its backlog of discrimination complaints to 70,000 last year. Ricardo Jones used to work for the EEOC as the senior federal investigator in the EEOC's New York district. Jones says the agency keeps the backlog down by wrongfully dismissing almost all black complaints of racial discrimination.
Their report is far worse than George Bush's report, and it's been going down since George Bush left office in 2008. At least George Bush, reasonable cause finding for race complaints, and when I say race complaints, that doesn't, you know, sort out all other races, but we as black people, African Americans, are in that statistic. But George Bush's success rate for race complaints was 3.5%. Once President Obama took over, that number dropped down to 3.1% and has held steady at 3.1%. Now, what does that mean? Most of us don't get the numbers. That means that probably 96.5% or 96.9% of the race complaints have been dismissed for African-Americans. And to say that our first black administration in the White House and the head of the EEOC was Jacqueline Barrons, which was appointed because she's Michelle Obama's Harvard Law School girlfriend, right? The best that they can do is worse than what President Bush did for African-Americans as far as race discrimination in America. I don't think that's anything to be proud of.
Now, the EEOC says it received almost 100,000 complaints last year. It reports that it only filed 122 lawsuits and resolved 254 lawsuits. There's a huge gap between the number of complaints, almost 100,000, and those complaints that actually were settled in the victim's favor.
You know, Glenn, I'm going to be honest with you. You know, I did take mathematics in school, so I didn't go to Harvard Law School or Harvard Business School, so I do understand basic mathematics. And if you're taking 100,000 complaints and you only do a small number of lawsuits, the real statistic that's missing that I think everybody should be concerned about is what is the number of African-American race complaints that have been litigated by the EEOC on behalf of African-Americans. That number is so small, it might be less than 5 for this whole country. Now, nobody's going to make anybody believe in this great country that we only have 5 or less than 5 cases of race discrimination that should be litigated in all these corporations and companies in this great country that we have today. Nobody will. But they won't post that statistic, the number of race complaints that have been litigated by the EEOC. The EEOC basically was created for black people. The majority of that 100,000 cases that were filed by black people filing race complaints. And the EEOC has systematically dismissed all of those race complaints and probably hasn't litigated very few. Maybe one. I've heard of one they did out in Los Angeles, and that's about it.
And yet black people have such a high profile at that agency.
Well, that's because they've been bamboozled, right? Because you put a token person. Ms. Jacqueline Barron is seriously a token. She is Michelle Obama's Harvard Law School girlfriend. I guess Michelle Obama will say, well, my girlfriend is qualified. I'd like to know, as a former federal investigator, senior federal investigator for the EEOC in New York City, and has been trained by a federal agency other than the EEOC in investigations and the United States Army, what makes Jacqueline Barron qualified to be the head of the EEOC? She never was the head of any other agency. Now she's the head of the highest civil rights agency in this country. And basically, she's just a token and a figurehead because she did not have the experience nor the knowledge to rein in the rogues at the EEOC.
And this would tend to say something about the priority that the EEOC gets or does not get under this administration.
Now you hit the nail on the head, Glenn. This administration's priority is to sit on all race complaints filed by African-American, whether it's the private sector or the federal sector. And I have information that other secretaries of, like, the Department of Veterans Affairs have been told to sit on all complaints of discrimination. And majority of all complaints of discrimination are filed by African-Americans. So basically, this administration is hiding the discrimination against African-Americans in both the private sector and the federal sector because they control the EEOC and the other check and balance agencies that are supposed to be enforcing the civil rights laws of 1964.
So if you just sit on those cases, well, maybe people will stop complaining and just go away, and then the numbers will disappear as well.
That's exactly what's going on, because what happens is once they dismiss a race complaint, and they basically dismiss race complaints based on the color of the skin of the complainants, which is black, you only get a right to sue. Now, they're making the public believe because you get a right to sue that that means something. It doesn't. You go into federal court, and you only have 90 days to pursue it in federal court. Most black people don't have the ability to file pro se in federal court or afford an attorney who can represent them in federal court. And even if they could, they still would lose because the federal court is biased. And the EEOC knows that. So what they're doing, they're passing the buck of dismissing race complaints to the federal judges. What the federal judges are doing, they're using that to get a bigger budget. I've heard that Supreme Court Justice Roberts is trying to get more money because the EEOC is passing more cases to federal courts, so they want a bigger budget. So what's happening is, Glenn, is they're pimping us. They're using our tragedy of discrimination in the workplace, which is guaranteed to us by the law, which isn't being enforced by the EEOC or any other civil rights agency, and they're using that to get more money for federal judges and federal court because the EEOC has failed drastically at their responsibilities and obligations.
The EEOC uses this euphemism, the word inventory to describe 70,000 cases. I guess that's the backlog, isn't it?
Well, the backlog is just a trick. It's a real good trick. And there is no backlog. The backlog has been created by the EEOC to give them time to dismiss more cases. And the EEOC is budgeted for overtime, but in the last 10 years, they've never paid one investigator or one mediator any overtime pay. Any business has a budget for overtime. Every federal agency has a budget for overtime. What the EEOC has been doing with its overtime budget is they're allowing their federal managers and their upper management to take junkets, take trips, stay in high-priced hotels. They never paid any investigators to work on anything that they should have been paid to work on if there was a backlog. So the backlog is fictitious. It's just a way to bamboozle the public because the public is not smart enough to look into what the EEOC is doing.
And what can the public do about what the EEOC is not doing?
Well, you know what they can do is they can reach out to the Senate committee that oversees the EEOC. The former chairperson, subcommittee head, was Ms. Patty Murray from the state of Washington. I heard she's being removed from the subcommittee that oversees the EEOC. But the committee head is a guy by the name of Tom Harkin from Iowa. And Tom Harkin is well aware of what's going on at the EEOC. But good old Senator Tom Harkin basically set up a deal with Ms. Jacqueline Barron. If you go back to the confirmation hearings of Jacqueline Barron when she was appointed in 2010 to the EEOC, Senator Harkin clearly wanted Jacqueline Barron to do something about the backlog. Well, in the first year, Jacqueline Barron did do something about the backlog. She didn't get confirmed. She got a recess appointment. At the end of that recess appointment, she went back to Tom Harkin and showed that she dismissed all the black complaints that were filed. She put an order out across the EEOC for every investigator to dismiss an additional 50 complaints on top of 100 complaints they were already dismissing. They were mandated to dismiss 150 complaints. And if you don't believe I said that, a ULP was filed by the EEOC's union against EEOC's management for requiring them to dismiss an extra 50 complaints in the fourth quarter of FY 2010. And they were mad because they didn't have enough time to do it. They weren't mad because they were doing something illegal. They were mad because they weren't given enough time to accomplish that. Once she dismissed those additional black complaints, she went back to Tom Harkin, and Tom Harkin confirmed her. And if you don't believe me, just check the statistics, just check the ULP filed by the union, and just check the confirmation hearings for Jacqueline Barron, and you can verify the information I just said.
So this is what the EEOC is actually doing when in their press release they say, they brag that they have reduced the pending inventory backlog of private sector charges by 10%.
They've dismissed an additional 10% of black complaints because the majority of all complaints to come in are complaints of race discrimination. But as soon as a race discrimination case comes in and the individual is African-American or foreign-born black, that case is automatically dismissed anyway. The statistics clearly show that. And Jacqueline Barron's order to dismiss an additional 50 complaints to every investigator across the country is just basically saying, I want you to dismiss more black complaints.
That was former EEOC investigator Ricardo Jones speaking from New York City.
It appears that the French and the Americans are preparing.
And that was the Black Agenda Report, and via the Black Agenda Radio, via Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. And that wraps up our show. We'll see everyone in the whirlwind next week.